Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Are we starting?
We're starting.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get your iPad out. Put on your Facebook Live and get ready for another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest. Here we are.
Here we are. Everything good with you?
Yeah, great.
Well, let's bring in our guest. It's PJ Scrantz. He's a former New York City firefighter, a 9/11 first responder, Bob. He has a stunning story, a breathtaking story. In addition, alcoholism and addiction and recovery, worked in the field, and I'm sure shares a lot of our ideas.
Oh, I got some questions for him.
All right, PJ, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Were you working in treatment in New York City?
Actually, I'm in South Florida.
Oh, okay.
And that's when, after my son died, I ended up getting divorced, like over 90% of the families. When you lose a young child, my son Dustin was 7 when he died in my arms.
Oh,
and that's when my world went upside down. You know, I was trained to save lives, an Army veteran, New York City fireman, and the one life I wanted to save, I was helpless. So, needless to say, the drug addiction and alcoholism went through the roof, and I lived in a dark place for quite a while.
Let's talk about some of the other... He survived with drugs.
That was a survival coping mechanism. I don't think drugs are bad.
Well, you were getting into quicksand here. Both you and I don't believe that there's such a thing as a bad drug.
That guy needed to take drugs for a while to get through.
And people's choice to use may be a survival technique, but addiction is bad. Addiction gets rough.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So I want to hear more about your firefighter experience. How did you and where you served in the military? Give us your whole story if you don't mind, PJ.
Well, yeah, I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and I come from a family that has alcoholism in it. My dad, you know, he drank a lot when I was growing up. He was an iron worker, hard worker, and, you know, drank after work every day. He did the best he could, and we had a nice life. But the reason I became a fireman was my godfather, my father's best friend, and his best man at his wedding, Bill Wren. He was the happiest guy I've ever seen. And from a little kid, I just knew all he did was smile. And I wanted to become a fireman like my godfather. So I joined the military first. I served in the United States Army. And when I got out of the Army, I took the test. I became a fireman, greatest job in the world, New York City Fire Department. And it was an amazing, amazing job up until 9/11. And 4 guys from my firehouse were killed. And actually, my godfather, he retired a lieutenant on the New York City Fire Department, only to take a job as the head of fire safety for the Twin Towers.
Oh.
And he was killed on 9/11 as well.
Oh, my God. We you know, my Susan and I, we spent a lot of time in New York, so we're sort of... We know lots of people that lost people. We're very connected with all that. What was the response pattern you had to follow on that day? Where did you go?
Well, I ended up, I was not working that day. I responded from home, like every other fireman that wasn't working. There was thousands and thousands and thousands of us that weren't working that responded. And when I got there, the, second building had just come down.
Oof.
And I was driving in a Jeep. If you remember that day, it was a beautiful September day. It was beautiful at night, cloud in the sky. And I was driving in my Jeep. I had a Jeep with no doors, no top. And I drove through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel to get into the city. And it was dust. You couldn't see 10 foot in front of your face. Oof. And I remember praying as I was going through that tunnel saying, I don't know what is coming, but please protect me.
that's the psyche of a responder. Just move forward.
Absolutely.
Like you're an addict, too.
Well, be fair. That's what makes you choose to be a responder.
No, because I have the junkie side of that. A bunch of my friends, like, when everyone was walking uptown, they were just hanging out by Canal Street, like, wanting to know what the hell's
going on.
Yeah, of course.
That's an addict move, for sure. That's the thing that people don't understand. Addicts are at their best in extreme situations. That's why they make great extreme athletes and shortstops and first responders. And for them, they're all whatever anxiety or depression in their life all goes away when they're in action.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's 100% true.
You get a little high from it. And
I had a friend of mine was in a yoga class downtown there. She walked out, saw what was happening before the first tower even went down, and just started going uptown.
Uptown. Get away. That's a normie.
Yeah, just get away. That's a normal person.
Yeah.
Then years later, I'm talking to these two guys out in front of a club that I played at, and they're old friends of mine from the 80s, and they're like, yeah, dude, we just hung out downtown. We were helping people, and...
Oh, boy.
So the junkies were down there helping, too.
Oh, my gosh. So that day ends, and then your son dies on the heels of that? It's just too much.
Well, you know what? This is how it went. My son, Dustin, was diagnosed with leukemia when he was 2.5 years old. Mm. And he was very, very sick. He was 98% compacted with leukemic cells. Jeez. And they told us on the very first day, they said, your son's probably not going to survive. And he fought for 4.5 years, and he died in my arms when he was 7.
Ugh.
And let me tell you something. You don't know how you're going to handle it, but I couldn't have handled it any worse, I don't think. I truly don't.
I don't know if there's such a thing as worse or good or bad with that. It just is how you handle it.
Yeah. I didn't know any better. I didn't picture this. When you're an Army veteran or anyone in the military or a first responder, you have to compartmentalize and stuff your feelings, because say if you respond and there's a little kid and his guts are hanging out, you can't cry, you can't panic, you can't feel. You have to do your job.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is what I had to do, but when it came to my son, how do you compartmentalize when your firstborn son at 7 years old dies in your arms? The champagne bottle, the cork just blew, and it blew big.
Did you immediately go to drugs, or did you act out aggressively, or what happened?
No. I'm not an aggressive guy like that. What I do is I become introverted. What I would do is, there wasn't enough cocaine, there wasn't enough alcohol.
Yeah.
I just drank, and I snorted cocaine, and I'd wait till everyone in my family went to sleep, and I'd have it out with God every night.
Okay,
curse everyone.
So that arguing about God, there. Whenever I have a trauma survivor like you, I recommend this book, which is a dumb self-help book. It's only like 90 pages long, by Rabbi Kushner, called Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People. You ever read that book?
I haven't, but I know of it.
Yeah. It changed my life. Because when you have a bad childhood and all these adverse things, and why does this happen to me? Why does this happen to me? God doesn't care about me. He cares about everyone else. That's how I lived my whole life. And I read that book, and it just was like, wow, I'm locked into a way of viewing things that is so...
What was the bottom line of the book?
The bottom line of the book is that you have to change what you know about God. You choose what you know about God. And what we're taught about God is God is all-knowing, all-powerful, and God is love. And so when your child dies in your arms when you pray and turn to God to save him...
Well, that's wrong.
One of those things has to go.
Yeah.
But think about it logically.
Yeah.
One of them has to go, and then the thing makes sense.
Yeah.
And I chose to believe this thing because I'm Catholic and grew up Catholic, that in the exchange out of paradise, God gave up some of his power to man.
Huh.
Right? Yeah. And then the universe makes sense. God is not all powerful. God is love and God is all knowing. That's the God I want.
Yeah.
Right? But can't change human events. Yeah. Can't keep a bullet from harming your child. And he says in the book that's so interesting, you can choose which one you remove. But what kind of world do you want to live in? If you want God to be all-knowing and all-powerful and not love, that's a pretty fucked up world. Right? Well, some people think that's the world we live in.
That's called Judaism, just so you know. That's what that is.
So. But that book helped me, and it's helped hundreds of my clients that I've recommended it to, and I always recommend it. But it looks like one of these dumb self-help books, you know, with the typical cover.
Right.
But it really... and also you have to want healing and you have to seek.
Well, that's there right then and there is the magic. And maybe how we got here so fast, I don't know. But I wonder if PJ has a feeling about this. Our sense, Bob and mine, is that we're in sort of a spiritual vacuum in this country right now. And we don't seem to want to get better.
We don't want out.
Yeah. And that's, you know, wanting, you know, better is something that we all have got to sort of come to here. How what's it going to take? What's your sense of it? What's your solution, PJ?
Well, everything that you just talked about really struck a chord with me, because when you speak of God, I came from a family that was raised Catholic as well, but we didn't go to church. We went on like Christmas Eve, maybe Easter Sunday, and my first experience, the first time I was told about God was when I was seven. My son died at seven. I had my younger brother died.
My brother Jamie,
and my parents sat me on my bed at 7 years old. My mother on one side, my father on the other, and all they said was, "Jamie went to heaven. He went to go live with God." And I remember at 7 years old going, I don't know who God is, but where's my brother?
Ugh.
And from that age, it probably scarred me. It was probably my first encounter with PTS, mm-hmm. obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and through the years and through life, I was trained, so to speak, not to feel.
Yeah.
And it was such a detriment. And to this day, I struggle with it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like you say, but when you talked about it's an action. If we want to heal, it takes action, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't want to heal, and that took action. And my action was to drink as much as I could, snort cocaine as much as I could, and stay angry and stay resentful and stay hurt and sad and all of that stuff. And what I found was, and this is for me, I'm not a Bible thumping guy, but I'm a believer, because I want to see my son again. Mm. And with my faith just giving me hope that I'll see him again is a good enough reason to have my faith. So yeah. What I do is I pray and I talk to God, whatever everyone's God is. I know that in the rooms of AA and NA, they talk about it could be anything you want it to be. For me, it's God. There's God. The word God is God. That's it. And when I got divorced, when my son passed away, because my wife said to me straight out, she said, I'm not going to bury the only other man I've ever loved, the first being our son. Mm. And when I got divorced, I moved down to South Florida, Delray Beach, the recovery capital of the world. And I remember that was September of 07. And come the week before Easter of 08, I'm driving in my Jeep, top down, doors off, gorgeous sunny day on A1A, palm trees going, and I hear a commercial on TV, on the radio, that says, talked about an Easter Sunday service at a church I've never heard of, Church of Christ Fellowship, and it's going to be at this place, this Kuzan Amphitheater, which I never heard of. And I remember looking up at the sky and saying, God, and people thought I was nuts because I was loud. I said, I'm going to go to this Easter Sunday service, but if you don't come back into my heart, I'm done with you. And I was crying, and it was the most amazing thing happened at that service. And I'll keep this real short, but the pastor, Kuzan Amphitheater holds about 3,000-4,000 people, had a massive stage and three huge screens, TV screens, jumbotrons. And the pastor came out, and what he said was, he sent TV crew. It's a city place. It's an affluent area in Palm Beach. And the TV crew asked just total strangers, what would you do if you were told you had 30 days left to live? And that hit me hard, because when my son's bone marrow transplant failed, they said, you have 6 weeks to say goodbye to your son. Mm-hmm. So here it was, I'm going through the emotions. You know, God was knocking on my door. And then they asked these young girls, were the first people. They go, we go shopping, we'd go this, and I get angry. Then they'd show a guy like my age and say, I tell my wife and my children I love them every day for 30 days. Now I'm a mess. I'm a complete mess. It's going back and forth and back and forth. And the last image on the screens was a woman, bald with no eyebrows. And her only statement was, I was just told that I have 30 days left to live. And you have to pardon me, I get emotional. I saw my son's face. And, you know, you can tell I'm not 100% healed, obviously, because I'm still, like, I get very emotional just talking about it.
Yeah, but I don't, unfortunately, well, those kinds of emotions that you're having right now aren't bad and don't necessarily need to go away. So they'll just diminish in their intensity and their effects. But you kind of want them to, you know, they're very real. You don't want to lose that.
It's what differentiates us from other animals.
And it's unfortunate that, you know, your expectation is to be able to compartmentalize that, right? Because you've dealt with so much that way.
But our society believes that.
It was easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it may sound absurd to some people, but it's easier for me because of my training.
Yeah.
And actually because of having an alcoholic father from as young as I can remember.
Yeah, totally get
like
it.
Like hiding in a closet.
Yeah, totally know? Get it. You've been dealing with trauma, and that's how you deal with it, is with dissociating from it,
right.
Disconnecting from it. I have a little, like, sort of alexithymia where I have trouble connecting to emotions of it. I was emotionally abused younger. And so I get how challenging it can be sometimes to get connected. And when you
I feel more and more connected to people feeling that, which has been my evolution. I just sit here and I think it's a wonderful thing to be a part of, that we're talking about real things, mm-hmm. about life, about what purpose is,
right.
what meaning is. Because I have complete contempt for our culture.
Oh,
you know what I mean? So when things are real...
Oh, you're like me. I don't like a lot of people.
When things are real, this is what it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be community. We're supposed to be supporting each other when we're having emotional remembrances of our child. We're supposed to be talking about real things.
Let me say,
not
the
Kardashians.
I am closer to Sam.
Right.
I'm closer to Sam Harris than I am to either of you two, and yet I do believe that real meaning, spirituality, God, whatever you want to call it, happens in those communal moments. Just what we were, what PJ was just sharing with us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's happening right now for sure.
That's what I'm saying.
Let's get on to a subject. Let's compartmentalize now and get on to a subject. What is going on down there in your region of the United States recovery world?
Outside of politicians not having a clue how severe, and this is both sides, not having a clue of how severe the opioid epidemic is and just drugs and alcohol.
Well, but about the drug,
general,
I'm talking about the drug treatment, the drug treatment industry in Florida.
It's
getting better. I know that.
You know,
it's getting better.
It is. It was, I've been here since 07, so I've seen it.
You
when
saw
it. Was at
you
its
saw
low.
It.
And it was so bad, so bad, that you would have halfway houses with guys that were owned them and were running
them.
We're feeding pills to the people that were living there. Like making money off of them doing that. It was like just so crazy.
You know, it goes
dying.
On.
Too many people are dying.
I got to tell you something, because it goes on here in L.A., and it had gone, not to the extent of Florida, but there are some. I was trained by a couple of old guard treatment center owners who had no problem confronting treatment owners at AA meetings, going over to their business and saying, you're a lying sack of shit motherfucker. jive ass motherfucker. That was Buddy Arnold's favorite line, right?
Yeah.
And it was very, we're protecting our industry's reputation amongst the owner operators and the clinicians who are in charge of the programs. I come from that generation of clinicians here and owners in LA. And so I've done it myself. I started hearing about it once 2010, 2011, about this, the shenanigans that were going on. I confronted people. I'd call them. I'd call the treatment center. I'd say, this is Bob Forrest, and luckily I was on Celebrity Rehab, so they knew who I was. I'd say, I'd like to talk to the owner, and I'd get him on the phone and go, you know, I've heard this and this and this and this and this about you and your treatment center, and unless I start hearing different things about your treatment center, or I really start to know that you're changing, I'm going to call the state. Just the threat of it at first, right?
But you need to do that. You know, being born and raised in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, I was figuring.
You never want to be a snitch. You never want to do this. But you want to know something? In this case, you have to call them out. You have to call the state because people are dying. It's no joke. And if they're not dead or dying from an overdose, they're suffering miserable lives until they die.
See, and I'm really optimistic about Florida because it was ground zero, because the feds went down there. I'm not one of these that says, oh, you should never have a treatment center in Florida ever again. I think this is the time where Florida could be revolutionary in ethical drug treatment and start to have some really innovative ideas on how to be of service to the addict community. For two reasons. One, because there's a lot of professionals down there who know how to run a treatment center. And two, you need to redeem the image of Florida and the treatment industry down there.
100%. Right? 100%.
And so I'm hoping that some good things start happening down there.
No, it will, and it has. It's already begun. And I could. It's like a perfect segue right here to what I'm about to say. I had made it my mission to help veterans now. That's my mission, helping veterans that are suffering PTSD, depression, suicide, alcohol, and drug addiction. And the reason it was forged into my heart, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, during the RNC, okay? And I was doing personal security for Kid Rock. He had a concert on that Sunday, the last day of the RNC, the day Donald Trump accepted the nomination. He was at the convention center, several miles away from this Jacob Pavilion where Kid Rock was going to have his concert. So every cop in Cleveland, cops from all over the country, they all converged at the convention center. I drive a triple black Hummer, H2, when I do security. I had a couple of women with me, and we had my Hummer filled with stuff for Kid Rock's green room. We go pulling into the arena, this venue, and somebody comes running up to me and says, look up, there's somebody going to jump off the bridge. It's the Detroit Superior Bridge. I look up, and there's a guy sitting about 125, 150 feet over ground, not over water, and he was going to jump. So I literally pushed these girls out of my Hummer. I go speeding back to where the gate is. They let me out. I go ripping up this bridge, and I confronted a homeless, I'm going to get emotional then, I'm sorry, a homeless drug-addicted veteran, okay? And when I took a step from my Hummer towards him, he leaned as if he was going to jump, and he goes, I got this. Mm. I got this. And now my heart's pounding. I'm saying, oh, my God, please don't do this. No, please. You know, I'm thinking to myself, I'm not saying this. So I said, so what's the problem, brother? I'm not here to hurt you. I said, I'm a retired New York City fireman. I said, I just want to talk. And he goes, I'm an Army vet. He goes, I did two tours in Fallujah. Now, Fallujah was very much a hot spot during the war, but I had to vet this guy myself to make sure he truly was a veteran. Anyone could say this, right? He was drug addicted. So I said, oh, wow. I said, I was Army, too. I said, what was your MOS? Most civilians wouldn't know what an MOS is. So he goes, 11 Bang Bang, which is 11 Bravo, which is a grunt. He fought. He was the guy fighting. Mm. So here he is. Now I knew. He saw things that, as much as I saw in my life, he probably saw 10 times worse. Mm. So here it is. Now I know he's a veteran, and we're talking, but he's still got to jump. So I'm saying, what do I do? What do I do? I'm thinking, and all of a sudden I said, I thought of my son. Whenever I think of my son, I can't help but get emotional. So I said, listen, I said, brother, I'm a dad. I lost my seven-year-old son. I could use a hug. And now all of a sudden, this hero, he's not thinking about Fallujah. He's not thinking about committing suicide. His eyes focused on my eyes. And I said, can I have a hug? And when he reached out to his arms to give me a hug, I pulled him down. And it changed my life. I made a vow that I am going to help veterans in a big way that are suffering. And for the past year, on my own dime, I traveled around the country and I vetted treatment centers that said that they had treatment tracks for veterans.
They all do.
And 95...
Yeah, but they don't. You know that.
They say they do. It's the same track that they give for the regular civilian.
Yeah.
But let me promise you something. These guys have traumas and things that regular civilians don't have. They have unique experiences.
Yeah.
So, you know, I found what I did was I seen something that was unique in one. And then I seen something that was unique in another. I seen one that was unique in this. And I said, what I'm going to do is I'm gonna find the right entity. I said, because my passion is off the charts. My motives are pure. And I said, I'm going to find a healthcare company. I'm going to find a treatment center where I could be the liaison for veterans and first responders, the poster boy for the place. Because they talk to me, and I need to add this. After I started healing, I wanted to honor my son, and what I did was I founded a charity that helped military, cops, and firemen with critically ill kids because I walked in those shoes.
Is that Believe?
And what I know it's called Wish Givers. Believe is my charity now for veterans. Wishgivers.org. I founded with my ex-wife. And what I found was over years, three or four years' time, I had to go and find these veterans and first responders. You know why? They had sick and dying kids because they don't know how to ask for help.
Right.
They don't know how to ask for help. I would have to scour newspapers and the internet. And I ended up, first family I helped was a Boston firefighter, Chris Shanahan. He has a son, Brendan. 2.5 years old, leukemia, same leukemia as my son. And because my motives were pure, I ended up reaching out to this guy, William Callip, who owns John F. Kennedy's presidential yacht, the Honey Fitz. And I knock down doors. I don't ask. I say, listen, we need your yacht to do a Boston Harbor cruise for a Boston firefighter with a 2.5-year-old son with leukemia. Can you imagine that? Some fireman from New York called you up. You own a $28 million yacht that was John F. Kennedy's. Mm. And you know what he said? No problem. Anytime you want it. And we did a Boston Harbor cruise for this family. And young Brendan, who was 2.5 at the time, just celebrated his 7th birthday.
Wow.
And I became really good friends with the father. When Brendan celebrated his 7th birthday, I did a Facebook post. I had Brendan celebrating his 7th birthday in his dad's fire helmet, side by side with a picture of me and my son Dustin with my fire helmet on, fire department in New York. And one was celebrating his 7th birthday, and my son was tied at 7. Hey, it was very powerful.
I got a question for you. Through all your travels across the country, you ever met a woman who's very passionate about helping veterans named Susie Landolfi? She works with Wounded Warriors.
No, I've been told by several people that I need to meet this woman. No, I never have.
She's the greatest. You got it. Now she's in Connecticut, I think, but she started out in Malibu. I was working with her. She just has a miracle way, and she worked in drug treatment, before all this, in the 90s, and so she has this ability to navigate both sides of the equation like no one I've ever known before.
Wow.
She has a nonprofit called the Big Heart Ranch, and she's just the
best. I've heard of that.
Yeah, yeah. She's just the best. And I, you know why I say that? I don't know that I should speak about her, but her grandson has gone through what you're talking about with the cancer and leukemia. Why is it happening so much with kids, Drew?
That's who gets lymphocytic leukemia.
It's so sad.
Listen, I had friends die of it when I was a kid. And that's it used to be an automatic death penalty. Now it's you can
usually... No, the kids are surviving. Her grandson's
usually,
doing well.
Usually you can get... But sometimes you can't.
But it's strange that all this trauma the most traumatized, not saying myself, I'm not in competition with, but trauma survivors who can start to heal become helpers of healing, right? And that's what you're doing. That's what I do. That's what Susie does. That's what everybody who really is good in the field does, right? Yeah. The industry, our industry, that Drew was lucky enough to just amscray from when it got really ugly and bad, our industry is not filled with the healers anymore. It's filled with the people who want to make profits.
Mm-hmm. And it's filled with greedy people. Right.
Yeah, and we've got to turn it around. You and me need to speak up more and speak out more, and I appreciate what going around and vetting these programs. I always had a really quick, sarcastic, punk rock reaction. Just, I tell people, if a treatment center specializes in everything, they probably aren't good at anything.
Right, they specialize in
Gotcha. So they specialize in veterans and bipolar, in dual diagnosis, in young people, in eating disorders, in sex addiction. Yeah. Any website that says that is a disqualifier that you should send your family
there. Which is most.
Is that very interesting?
Right.
So let's go through your stuff. It's Valiv.org, right? That's the...
Yes. It's a fledgling. It's in its infancy, and it's geared strictly for veterans and their issues, and not a litany of issues. It's specific to PTSD and the drug and alcohol addiction,
it's a smorgasbord. But let me ask you something.
Believe with a V, V-E-L-I-E-V.
Drew and I are very interested in ibogaine and hallucinogens being used for PTSD. You must have known a lot of soldiers MDMA. That have done that, right?
Oh, absolutely. I know. I'll tell you what. I'm one of these guys that, you know, everybody wants to. Like you said, our country is hurting really bad.
Really
and
bad.
There's no unity. We're so divided where the left is so left and the right is so right. And you want to know something? I was raised by Kennedy Democrats, but I'm a Republican.
Right.
But I'm a Kennedy Democrat.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm the guy that meets in the middle.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's you're going to join us. You know you're going to join us in this thing. Drew and I are trying to call something the radicalize the center.
Yeah.
The radical center.
That's right. There you go. And that's what we need. It is.
I was raised a Goldwater Republican and then ended up a liberal because I went to college in the 70s, and now I'm back towards the radical center.
And then, PJ,
I'm radical center.
You also have a podcast that's Serving Those Who Serve, is that right?
Yes. Yes, Serving Those Who Serve. You know what it is? I want to zone in. I don't want to be somebody that does a lot of different things and does it okay. I want to do one or two things and do them really well, because we really do have to. We're in a position like right now with you two, when you two guys speak, you're saving lives. You're professionals. There's somebody listening to this and they're crying, and they're at the cusp. Either they're going to die or they're going to get help. Yeah. So literally, as you guys speak, you're saving lives. So this is what I want to do. This is my life's mission. I want to save lives. There's no joke. There's no game. I mean, I can tell you, and because I have to. I went to a treatment center in Ohio, and the guy, God bless his heart, he was an attorney. He bought a hotel, the hotel, it was a big, big hotel.
Yeah. Drew's favorite people, by the way. Lawyers are running treatment centers.
Big, giant operations.
Yeah, he called it. He called it Hotel California. He was going to keep it a hotel. And he had all the fake palm trees. Beautiful, beautiful place. But he didn't realize that the Eagles were going to sue him.
Oh, my God.
So he had to lose the name.
Oh.
So he said he was going to lose millions of dollars. So he's a bright guy. He says, wow. He did some reading and research. He goes, I'm going to come up with a treatment center for combat veterans.
All right.
And it's got, you know, something. Which is,
that's
you know,
good.
Yeah, but his motives, you know, maybe the motives, maybe they were for you or maybe they weren't. Not my business.
Yeah.
And he did have a couple of really cool things that within his treatment track that I've never seen before. Like every veteran that goes there, they're given a puppy. And a cage, and they're trained to be service dogs. So the veteran gets to train them with the professional trainers.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And if the veteran, when he leaves or she leaves, if they need a service dog, they have it. And if they don't need one, it goes to a veteran that needs it. I thought that was a brilliant idea.
Anyway, I
met this young Marine. His name was Andrew. I'm not going to give his last name. He said I could, but I won't do it. Anyway, this guy, I sat outside this place for 2 hours speaking with him. And he shows me, lifts up his shirt. He goes, I apologize. This isn't who I am. He goes, I got hooked on heroin. Hooked on the opioids, then went to heroin. Typical story. He goes, he lifts up his shirt, and he's got these hellacious scars. His first tour. He goes over there, his Humvee gets blown up, his lieutenants get killed, he gets shrapnel in his lungs, he gets sent back to the States, gets hooked up, not hooked on opioids, takes the opioids, weans off of them, goes back just to do another mission. Another bomb goes off, blows his teeth out, does all this kind of stuff. Now he gets addicted to opioids. And the way the VA works, as we know, they don't see you quickly. So when you run out of a prescription, if they don't fill it because they have to see you first,
heroin,
they go through withdrawn heroin, right?
Yeah, right.
So anyway, he goes like this. He goes, just understand that this isn't who I am. He's like apologizing to me. I said, listen, Marine, you're a hero. You don't have to apologize to me. I said, are you kidding me? So this guy that owns the place, he goes, Andrew, why don't you show PJ your medals? And he made a face like he didn't want to show me the medals, but he broke out this case, two purple hearts, a silver star, all of this. But he's so humble. It's like, it's no big deal. You know, this is my, he goes, but I do want to show you one thing. He goes, can I show him my Facebook? And he takes me on a computer and he shows me a picture of himself before he got injured, before he was addicted to heroin, in full dress uniform, the Marines' full dress uniform, 30 pounds heavier, side by side with General Mattis, who commands our military.
Yeah.
And here it is, and he goes, he points at it as, I'm going to cry again, I'm sorry.
Oh,
he goes like this, he goes, this, what you're looking at here, who you're talking to is not who I am. He goes, see that guy in the picture? He goes, that's who I am. And I said, I know that, brother. You know, and we have to do more. We just have to do more.
Well, that's a fact. We have to do more.
And PJ, we're gonna have to leave it at that.
People like you are gonna change it.
I think that's as big an endorsement as we can possibly give to motivate people to do so. So, one more time, the website, Valiv.org, is that where you want people to go?
Valiv.org is great. Actually, you want to know something? They can hit me up on Facebook and friend request me.
There you go.
That's PJ, perfect.
PJ Schrantz.
I answer to everybody. PJ Schrantz, Schrantz.
All right,
that's
PJ.
Me, PJ Schrantz.
Thank you, man.
Keep fighting the good fight.
Hopefully
down
there. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Thank you, gentlemen. Right. You have a great day.
All right, cool.
Hey, we are very excited to welcome our friends at Bergamot. That's a brand that made a significant impact on me. They make a variety of supplements. They use extract from the bergamot citrus fruit. They act as a natural statin and can improve a number of cardiovascular parameters, things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high blood sugar, insulin resistance, all the metabolic syndrome stuff. Now the makers also bring you Bergamot Sport that provides all the same benefits with additional additives designed to help athletes and those with an active lifestyle. Bergamot Sport may help improve stamina as well as reduce recovery time as well as muscle inflammation. I've used the product myself. I've recommended it to patients, and Susan uses it. My wife, Susan, you've been using the Bergafem for over a year, so what do you think about it?
After I reached 45, things started changing. Changes in libido, energy, and metabolism.
What?
And
no way.
Then there are hot flashes that you know about, right, Jim?
Yes.
My doctor prescribed bioidentical pellets every 4 months, and then I got hot flashes and felt fatigued at the end of my cycle. Bergafem fixed all of that for me. I took it for a year and ran out, and the hot flashes came back, and a little weight gain in my waist as well. So I'm taking one tablet a day to keep the libido strong, sleeping better, and I also noticed a loss of abdominal fat, honey.
Ooh, you're perfect. Is that the right response for husbands? So try Bergamet Sport for yourself. Visit Bergamet.com for all the products that may be right for you. That's B-E-R-G-A-M-E-T, Bergamet.com. Or click the Bergamet banner at DrDrew.com. And for a limited time, our listeners save an additional 10% on their order by entering the code DRDREW. That's just Dr. Drew at checkout. All one word, DRDREW.
To learn more about Bergafem, please visit Bergamet.com today. Love it.
Yeah, you do. You've been using it right along. It's worked. So, yes, welcome. And it's our privilege to bring...
My favorite guys in the podcast world.
Go ahead. Interview.
No way.
Yes. He said that before even.
How do you think you got Drew on your podcast? Come on.
I thought I baited him. I thought I baited him in Twitter.
By taunting him.
I thought I taunted him to come on.
It is. They have the great. It's a dopey podcast. They have the greatest way of engaging, I think, active addicts in listening to. And then the final thing is, all you guys are sober.
Yeah, that's true. We say they tune in for the debauchery and then they end up staying for the recovery.
I love that.
Chris has quite a story.
That is tied to our story.
Yes. But see, now you got both of us, Chris. Has that podcast aired yet, the one that I did with you guys?
Yes. Yes. We've gotten a bunch of feedback and stuff, too.
Positive? Negative?
Mostly positive stuff. We had a couple people. One woman got a little upset about the optimal frustration piece, and she didn't really understand. She thought it was like, that's not true for people of low socioeconomic status. And I explained to her, I was like, it's really about tolerating feelings. And that sort of theory is universal, whether somebody's wealthy or not.
Oh, yeah. And listen, there may be people that can't tolerate any frustration and who are polydiagnosed with no resources. And, yeah, that's somebody who may need to go on methadone or Suboxone or something. But if somebody wants to get well, you have to be able to dose out optimal frustration. That's our job. Chris, Bob, you disagree?
Yeah, absolutely. Chris is an example of a guy like me that tried for 10 – how many years going in and out of rehabs?
A decade.
10
yeah.
years,
yeah.
right? So And yeah. so did I. And somehow now that just – oh, they'll die if we proselytize abstinence-based treatment. No. We both survived, and millions of Americans survived in an abstinence-based treatment world. Now, like everything else, if there's some babies that can't handle it, we'll change everything and just have replacement therapy for everybody.
So, wait, how do we introduce our guest? You and I know them well. The dopey world knows them well. What for the virgins
there's,
to these guys?
Because I promote them all the time. They're sober guys who love telling the tales of the drug debauchery. And that's every rehab, every smoking area, that's what drug addicts do. That's how they bond.
Bob, that's stigmatizing. How dare you?
I'm going to say this. My name is David. Me and Chris make Dopey. And Dopey is the greatest podcast in the history of podcasts. And our niche is addiction, and we happen to be sober. So what the fuck?
Yeah, you know? But you talk about shooting speed up in coconut trees and stuff. I mean, it's not.
Well, I think you talked about shooting speed in coconut trees.
What?
Bob. I think that was you.
This is actually a story I haven't heard.
Well, just where you have to get alone somewhere. I didn't actually do it. I just knew a drug addict that did it.
And right.
Isolating, so it needed to isolate
well,
so
somebody,
badly.
Well, if you get paranoid in your house and you're scared the AA police is going to burst in and take you to rehab
again, meth.
It's best to get up somewhere high where you can see.
Huh.
Definitely.
Cocaine.
I would say cocaine. Cocaine is always cocaine. Up.
Yeah,
remember Shifty went out on the roof?
Yeah,
up. Everyone goes up with cocaine.
Yeah.
And when you get paranoid, you always see people in the trees.
Yeah.
It's weird. That's a very strange thing.
I think one of the greatest stories I heard all time was Bob, you telling me about your friend that you do the other show with and him cutting the worm out of his
thigh. Yeah, the worm
out.
Mike Mark. Mike Mark. So I was if I was an 8 on a 10 scale drug addict, my friend Mike, the guitar player from Thelonious, was 9 on a 10 scale.
Hold on a second. I've never met that guy.
Mike Martin has been sober longer than me.
I've never met fill in the blank more of a drug addict than you. I've never met anybody like that. Maybe Chris. Chris is close.
Chris is
bad. Chris is like bad.
So Mike was smoking too much crack because he's the only person ever kicked out of Thelonious Monster because of drugs.
Bob, is there such a thing as right amount of crack? This just was too
much crack. Well, in a substance use disorder world, obviously some people must use that substance properly.
Yes, right.
So Mike is paranoid, and I keep telling him, and you know how I was. This is way beyond.
Oh, yes, I do know how you were.
And I keep telling him, Mike, there's no worms in your body. And so he, to prove to me, he was in a particularly tweaker mood, and he traced a worm into the fat part of his leg, cut it off with a knife, and put it in a mayonnaise jar.
Showed it to you.
To show me, to prove to me that there was a worm in it.
Yeah. I've seen people do stuff like that. I've seen people, you know, dig.
What is the worms in your skin about? Well, I never had that one. Chris, did you have worms in your skin?
No, I had no worms. I just had police sirens. As soon as I'd chew coke, the police sirens would start, and they were coming for me.
Yeah.
Right. The uniformed officers is from cocaine and crack. And then meth is paranoia, elaborate
family,
paranoia,
family
friends, coworkers, neighbors. And then Pickers syndrome. And Pickers is this feeling there's something in the skin. Glass, bugs, something.
The crack bugs. The meth bugs.
Meth bugs. You have meth to pull bugs. Them out. Dave, did you do meth? Was that one of your drugs?
I did, but not for a long period of time. I like used meth as like a back door back into heroin.
Right.
Like I was clean and in California, and my buddy was doing meth, and I was like, "Well, I bet if I try meth, I'll need to do heroin again." And that worked out.
Dave is a neurotic Jew. He can't go up. If he goes up, it's really really bad. He has to go down.
Down
is the only way I can go.
So, and you're getting the spirit of the Dopey Podcast here. It is something that builds community, and then we can talk about real things. Right.
Yeah.
And they found a way to bring it in an entertaining way, but you always know it's about recovery. That's what I love about
Chris told me his whole story back at our hospital.
Yeah, he left. He went to the psych ward.
But he was in this for months in the psych piece. And
but not in the lockdown, in the regular 2 weeks.
And he was at Nash for a while.
Yeah,
he was back and forth, but not 2 weeks, like 8 months.
No, 2 East is what they called.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where you were, Chris. 2 East.
Yeah,
I was literally all of Mariah, 2 East, Hack, Nash, Gables, Breyer, every single ward I was.
You must have had some great insurance, my
friend. No, he had rich parents.
I think he had both.
Even
but Chris's
better.
Hallmark, Chris's hallmark of treatment, if the place said you should stay for this long, multiply that by 8. And that's how long Chris stayed in the facility.
And he had, you know, was super medicated. And
benzos? They give you benzos
up
there?
No, of course. But listen, but also everything you and I know we had problems with, Chris was exploiting.
Chris, you were pre-Suboxone, though, so they weren't giving Suboxone to you up there, were they?
No, they were. I told Drew when we had him on our show.
In Dr. Drew's hospital, they were giving Suboxone. I can't
Not on the chemical dependency.
I know.
Not in our unit. And describe people how you played that psychiatric game.
Well, the first thing I did was when I checked in there, I was just running around the streets of Pasadena. I had ran away from Impact, and I was just like stealing beef jerkies and 40s. And I had this idea, and I guess a lot of people do it. It was actually an original thought at the time, was maybe if I go in and just pretend I'm withdrawing really bad, they'll load me up on medication. So the first thing I did, which kind of set the pace for the rest of the time, was I told them I was drinking a handle of vodka a day, I was shooting a bundle of dope and taking benzos, and I sat on my hands and I pretend to be shaking, and they gave me a shitload of medication, and I ended up blacking out for 2 weeks, and Bob, I was transferred eventually to Breyer under the care of Drew and Blum, and they were the guys that figured out what happened. They said, did somebody drug test him when he came in? You know, and
I remember cases like this. You weren't the only one, my friend, but it was always impressive. It's always
Chris,
impressive.
Wait, hold on. I have a quick question. You always tell this story, and you always say you were sitting on your hands. That's to simulate the shakes?
No, to like pretend I was ashamed of how much my hands were shaking. So manipulative.
That's
like
junkie.
I was trying to hide it.
Full-on junkie move.
Hey, since I'm talking to two real junkies that aren't ashamed of it, can I ask you a question? Elvis, yeah. Who you know, who's been to your restaurant, got caught at school calling a kid an asshole, right? And so he got brought to the principal's office on Thursday. And the principal asked him where he heard that word before. And my son, like a champion, said, I can't recall.
Oh.
Uh-oh. That's a junkie move, uh-oh. Right? That's a junkie move. Because yes. He didn't want to throw dad under the bus.
You should be very proud. Very proud.
I thought you guys would love that. I thought you guys would love that.
I just noted that David is...
Dave has met Elvis.
I would say David is proud and Chris is alarmed. I'm just making note.
My daughter is so quick to snitch me out. It's ridiculous. She throws me under the bus at every... And she's not going to... I don't think she's going to be the addict because she's the classic snitch.
Right.
She like takes pleasure
sober
in
police,
it.
Sober police. But listen, I want Chris also to tell you there's one story that stuck with me about when they were giving you all that Seroquel and you were in the locked unit.
Oh yeah.
Don't use doctor names, but tell.
I know what doctor it is.
Okay, so go
of
ahead.
Course,
all
of
he
course.
Has to say is rich, and I know who which doctor it is.
There was a bunch of different doctors sort of that happened, but the moment
all
Drew
of them.
Was talking about.
Oh,
it,
and your family's uber rich. Wait a minute, Drew just did a signal to me. It was all of those doctors. There was like four of them at Las Encinas. Chris, did you have all four of them attending you?
At one time or another.
Throughout different periods, I was transferred around a lot. And to clarify, I went in and I pretended all those withdrawal symptoms, but then from there it started to be seen as a more of a psychiatric thing because there probably was some legit stuff going on. But on top of that, I was intentionally like acting out and freaking out to get put in restraints and to get the booty juice and get
booty
put
juice.
To pack, and then they transfer me out. So. They thought I had like really intense aggression, but really I was just, you know, med seeking in a psychiatric hospital.
So clever.
The moment, Bob, that Drew was talking about was they had,
he's in the Cat's Deli office.
I know.
Yeah, he's in-
Come on, David. Take care
Shit
of
it. Shit is serious. I'm sorry. I'll mute it. Hold on.
Can you know that?
Chris is telling us an important story.
So what he was talking about, Bob, was I was, I was on one of the units there, and four times a day, they had me taking 300 milligrams of Seroquel, 1 milligram of Klonopin, and 8 milligrams of Suboxone. And then I was probably on Lamictal and other stuff, too. But as I was on 1,200 milligrams of Seroquel a day, I gained 60 pounds. I could barely walk up the stairs. I was sleeping 16 hours a day. And my parents flew out from Boston to visit me. And my mom talks about it now, and she laughs at it, and she says she was looking at me in bed, and, you know, the doctors were all bedside because I don't leave my bed. and he turns to my mom and dad and says, doesn't Chris look great? And my mom said at that same moment she was thinking it was the worst that she had ever seen me, including when I was active.
I know. That's crazy. So that happened.
I'm trying to give the psychiatric community a little bit of an out here. Do you think you had a drug-induced mania maybe also?
I don't know if I had the drug-induced mania. And we didn't mention this on the show, Drew, but at the end, you know, I told you when we weren't recording that I did have a brain injury in my prefrontal cortex. And I was really, really impulsive. And I think that some of the stuff I was doing might have been a result of just the traumatic brain injury. Right. And then that looked maybe psychiatric in a different way.
But really what
we're talking about is that the cure is worse than the disease.
No, I truly think. No, I think we're talking.
He became incapable of functioning outside of a psychiatric hospital because of over-medication, over-diagnosing, not spotting the brain injury, not identifying the addiction problem, and that's going on. Now, that you're talking about 15 years ago, that was financially motivated. There were, and unfortunately, a lot of rich people were marginalized and hospitalized and just crippled by the psychiatric
the very
industry.
Rich and the
well,
very
well, let me
but
just
now
let me
it's
interrupt
happening
for
to
Bob, they said when I saw that specific doctor, I went to transfer to a different doctor, and he said that I need $10,000 to sign the paperwork to transfer to the other doctor.
I know. We know who the doctor is. Yeah. But let me tell you something, though. I think what happened to you because of resources is now happening to millions of Americans just because of a bureaucratic healthcare system that is broken.
I don't know. I had a different kind of situation, though.
Go ahead, David.
Because I did not. I mean, I went to a couple of really nice facilities, but the treatment I received was usually the public detox at like Mount Sinai or at Beth Israel or whatever. And I was like sick the whole time. Like I was not bloated and high and shit. I was uncomfortable and miserable wherever I went.
Good.
Well, that's what I want. That's what I want everywhere.
Sorry. I know. Sorry, but it's good for you. But listen.
No, of course. But it was always public places. They were like, you can get some fucking, what's this stuff? The clonidine. Good luck. You're not going to die from
you guys have been sober a long time now. The system that started when Obamacare was upheld at the Supreme Court is now that same system writ large with a bureaucratic insurance bonanza.
But that's hopefully going to change a little bit as time goes on. But I want to go back to God darn it! You guys said something.
I want to tell them the good news.
You said the cure is worse than the illness, but I think we're actually looking at something different, which is the endemic problem is doctors believing their patients. That's at the core. The reason we were able to see through Chris's bullshit is because we were on guard, Blum and I, all the time, and with your help, we would see through the bullshit, and we would know what to do then. But the average physician knows nothing about that.
But I don't think it's like this anymore. I think it's chronic pain. I think the 12 of the 20 million people, by what I've seen reported in the research about OxyContin, 12 of the 20 million people had a medical reason to take OxyContin that was off-label. It's not what it was designed for. Chronic pain. And I'm saying they're making these chronic pain people into Chris at the Los Angeles Hospital.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
That's
a shame where the cure is worse than the disease.
It's a little different, but that's another layer to this. But,
right?
Yeah.
So what I wanted to tell you guys, and I wanted to do it live on the podcast, I'm moving to Red Hook, Brooklyn, you guys. I'm going to be able to walk to Cat's Deli.
You are?
Yeah.
What?
No.
Yeah. Just for the summer.
So
I'm working with Lehigh University out in Pennsylvania, and I didn't want to live out there. And then I tracked that it's only 80 miles from Brooklyn. I can just drive out there every day.
So
I drove to Temecula every day.
We got to take the train to Lehigh, maybe.
That's what everybody says, but I'm an L.A. guy. I like my car.
No, Bob. I commute an hour and a half every day. From deep Long Island to the Lower East Side. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You better have Wi-Fi,
train.
Bob.
We just got to go to New York and do 10 shows.
You better learn how to Skype, Bob.
Oh, God.
We just go to New York, we'll do 10 shows in a row. It's all we'll meet you.
You guys got to come to New York.
No, fuck that. You'll just start coming on Dopey. Never mind this this life. You'll be the third on Dopey.
There you go.
Oh,
Wait a minute. Somebody just walked in here.
Yeah, Mike.
Grab a mic. Headphone. Mike Catherwood, who
Mike,
does the Swole
Patrol who's
with
been
me.
Doing a dopey type thing for 18
camera,
years
Mike.
On LA radio, is right here.
Scooch towards the camera so they can.
Mike, have you ever heard the Dopey podcast about all the romantic stories of drugs?
I have.
These are the guys. They're on with us right
hey
now.
So
Mike, you've heard of Dopey?
I have.
Mike,
how? From Bob?
Actually, because I saw Drew on Instagram. Sandwich between you guys, and then I went to research it because I'm in recovery and
Mike has some
dope.
And he loves drug stories.
Mike has better stories than anybody.
I just love drugs. How about that? Let's just leave it at that.
You got to have Mike on separately because Mike has dopey stories that'll blow your mind. Right. Just tell him a quick one. The guy with the cat. That's one of my favorite.
I went to buy meth in Apple Valley, which is like
the meth capital of Southern California.
Well, yeah, and for New Yorkers or for anyone outside of Southern California. It's like Breaking Bad portrays a meth lab.
Yes.
That is every place in Apple Valley.
Yes.
Just desolate tumbleweeds in front and everything. We drive out there. We pull up, and these guys come out to see us at the car. and one of them is super buff. I mean, obnoxiously
meth
muscular.
Buff?
Roided.
Meth?
No, roided. No, 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 no. Like roided out buff to protect meth buff. And he's wearing a wife beater tank top, and under and outside of one of the straps, I could see peeking out just a giant swastika tattoo. And I'm like,
there you
oh.
go.
I'm like, oh great, we're in for a this is a party. So we go inside. The guy who answers the door, or who lives there, his name is Vamp. He calls himself Vamp because he looks like a vampire. He's like 11 feet tall with long hair, and he's super skinny with his shirt off and super pale. So he sits down at like a circular kitchen table, and we're on one side, my friend and I, and he's on the other.
You're buying meth from
him?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Big deal?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Normally, you're dead. Oh, but you're here. You didn't get killed.
No. Luckily. Now, you know, normally we buy meth from this one person. He was not available, so he finally just broke down and hooked us up with the guy he gets it from, who is this vamp guy.
Whoa.
So we go and we can sit down. We're at the table. We're chit-chatting for maybe 3 minutes. And over to our left is on the kitchen counter, there's an open bag of, like, the, you know, individual sale.
Yeah.
Like,
Chips Ahoy?
No, Chips Ahoy. Yes, thank you, Drew. It's not a box, like a bag that comes, you buy it like Costco.
With little chips.
Right, you would buy like 20 of these bags.
Yeah.
One of them's half open, and a cat is on the kitchen counter putting its face into these Chips Ahoy, right? And so,
You're nervous. You're crapping yourself.
I'm already so nervous, I'm ready to cry. But I don't want to cry in front of all these tough guys, and especially in front of vampire meth dealer, because I'm like, he'll fucking it'll take me for all I'm worth and have the Nazis bury me somewhere outside in his Apple Valley backyard. So the cat's eating the cookies, and I'm scared, and I'm like opening, closing my eyes, keeping my head down, and all of a sudden he pulls from underneath the table
a gun.
Let me just point this out, a gun that we did not know was there. So that alone scares the fuck out of me, because he's got a firearm, right?
A big one, like a huge.
It was a 9mm, and he goes, boom, and he shoot indoors. You know what a gunshot sounds like indoors, especially if you're
shot
not
the cat.
Shoots the fucking cat, and it just explodes. Boom! It just explodes, and I'm like, oh, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god.
Drew, I want to make note. Drew is laughing at this. A member of PETA.
No, I'm laughing because it's so insane. Mike told me the story before.
Mike, did he shoot the cat because it was his cookies, and he was mad that the cat ate his cookies?
He might have thought the cat was the kryptonite coming after it.
I think, gentlemen, I think we'd all be best served if we didn't try to make rationale out of what fucking vamp does.
Yeah.
But needless to say, that was like the fact that we made it out alive. I was holding my friend. He's holding my hand. And he's like, chill out, man. So get a hold of yourself. Get a hold of myself. He's like, shut again. So we get back in his car, and we're driving, and we're silent. Right, we're silent for maybe 40 minutes, and we get back on the freeway, and I was like, dude, never again. We got to clean up our life. This is out of control. What are we doing driving out here? 45 minutes after that, we're like, oh, dude, well, I can't wait to get back there. With a pipe in our mouth. Like, fuck it, this is great, man. Yeah.
There you go. A little bit.
That's a dopey story.
That's a dopey story right there.
Oh, my God.
That is classic dopey.
And we're all sober.
Y'all survived, thank God. That's the thing I'm always astonished at.
You know, well, you're the one that says addicts are better survivors. You got to have faith in it.
If there was ever any question, I advance to you the U4.
So. Have you heard there's actually a theory that they say that some of the genes associated with substance use disorders.
They think that
there was a random genetic mutation, and that addicts and alcoholics were actually, in an evolutionary sense, we were hardwired to survive, basically, better than the other people. Well, because when we found the fucking berries, we would eat all the fucking berries.
Well, it's a little different than that, Chris. It's a little different than that, because it's actually my theory. Somebody probably told you my theory. And that is, if this gene that created addiction was so destructive, it should have burned out of the human genome a long time ago. Instead, it stays consistent. And not only does it stay consistent, it emerges more powerfully in isolated populations under certain circumstances. What are those circumstances? Genocidal military assault over repeated generations. So Scotland, Central Europe, Ireland, North American Indian. The people that had to survive in extraordinary situations guess who? The addicts, alcoholics.
The addicts.
And I noticed this. I first noticed it when I saw the movie Braveheart, and they, you know, 10,000 Scotsmen go into battle. Three survive, clearly the alcoholics. And I started going into my treatment rooms and going, you may have been in one of these lectures, Chris, where I did this. And I said, "Who? What would you guys do if a bomb went off in the parking lot?
Figure it out.
All the addicts go right. I want to go right over there and check it out. All the non-addicts want to go the other way. So evidently, if there were, in fact, were a bunch of Huns coming over the hill with spears, you sort of being at your best and ready to fight would increase the probability of survival over somebody like me who would get a spear in the back running away. Does that make sense?
You know what?
That does. That makes sense.
Everything makes sense, but the last part about you getting a spear in the back, that's not necessarily true. I can't tell you how many doctors I have been in recovery with. You know, a lot of surgeons.
He's talking about him as a normal person.
Just a person.
But I don't
think he is a normal.
But I don't think people who make it through
surgeons make great
surgeons.
But I don't think Drew would abandon the four of us. I don't think he would run.
No,
think you'd certainly be behind us. Yeah. I think Mike would be out front.
I don't know. I would. You know what? You know what I'd be doing? I'd be yelling at Drew because he, for the past hour, would be going, "This is it. This is the end, guys. We're fucked. We're totally fucked. They're going to kill us all. We're all dead. We might as well just kill ourselves because they're going to come in here and they're going to take us and they're going to step and they're going to torture us. They're going to torture our family. What am I going to do? I've got triplets. What am I supposed to do?"
Mike and I have clearly worked together way too long. Way too long.
Here we go.
But the point is, yes, I would hope I would hang in, but my biology would be I would certainly not be activated by the experience.
No, I would be turned on. I want it to happen, don't you?
Yeah.
Where are the Huns when you need them?
Oh, my God.
Well, there's something about too, drinking and using that, you know, I certainly don't miss it, the lifestyle that I engage in.
The pooping and all the problems you don't miss.
But my life is very unexciting, and there was a charge I used to get out of going to dark alleys, meeting with gangbangers and you know, it's stuff that I...
Here's what I think is missing now. You can still do that. You just have to go there to help the drug addicts get out of there.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I've got to...
All right, we got to go.
No, we don't. You guys can keep talking. I'm going to go set up this call.
Okay.
I'm going to make Bob and Mike listen to this call I'm going to take with the White House in a minute.
I was going to make a joke that you're going to have to call
That's
Sarah Huckabee Sanders or something, but turns out you really
do. That's what I'm doing, so hold on. Chris and Dave, I'll see you guys in New York someday soon. Probably at Bob's house.
Yeah. Red Hook.
Thank you, Dr. Drew.
Red Hook, baby. So
yeah, but what you were talking about, Bob, it's like, you know, and Mike, is that going into the alley, that excitement and stuff. Like I really believe, like, that's something that's still with me. And Dave and I were talking about on the podcast, like, Dave said, you know, the lights went out at his place of work, and like everybody freaks out, and Dave's like excited, like something abnormal happened. When I was in jail, I used to want riots to happen. I didn't want to be involved in the riot, which you automatically are, but I remember when it was about to pop off, I would get excited. And most people are like getting nervous and like, this is going to be great. Like, something's going to happen and it's going to be awesome.
I was going to ask Drew. I mean, doesn't Drew get excited when a blizzard is coming because it's different?
No.
Because you don't know what's going to happen?
He doesn't.
No, Drew is not that guy.
No, I am that guy, and that's why I'm coming to New York.
Well, we're excited to have you. You're going to come in?
I hope a Northeastern is still one more is left before I get there in April or May.
You might get a hurricane over the summer. Hopefully there will be no more fucking Nor'easters. We need spring. Enough of this bullshit, man.
I might need help on the train thing, but I'll see you guys when I get there. I'll be out there at the end of April.
For sure.
You come in, and you come in person, so we don't have to deal with your cell phone in the car and all that bullshit.
Yeah, no, I'm going to come to your guys' show, but I'm coming to Cats for sure, but on a weekday when it's not all crowded and there's a line down the block. That was a nightmare that day.
How long are you going to be in New York, Bob?
Just through the summer to the fall.
Like from what month to what month?
From like... probably May 1st is the lease for 6 months.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
But I'm going back and forth. I have the Claremont
house. I guess Mike, you got some free time in the summer to do some podcasts?
Sure.
Dodger fan? Oh, the Dodgers are playing. All right, you guys, we'll talk to you later. Great to hear from you.
And
get
also,
back to work.
Tell everybody where to find you.
Wonderful. Yes. We're on iTunes, the Apple Podcast app, just anywhere. Just search for Dopey Podcast. We're on all the different mediums. And thank you for having us. And Mike, please come on the show and tell another story.
Absolutely, yeah. Guys. Absolutely. You do great work.
Chris,
thanks,
tell the website, man. Tell them to buy a shirt, man. We
need Dopey
money.
Podcast. We've had this shitty-ass website, and we finally paid somebody to fix it. And literally, people have been trying to order T-shirts for a year and a half, and it just bounces back, and you can't do it. But we finally fixed it. If somebody wants a Dopey T-shirt, go to dopeypodcast.com, and we can get one.
Okay, cool. Those dope
Thanks,
guys.
Guys.
Dope
Thanks,
podcast.
Guys.
See you later. Have a good
See
Sunday.
Later, guys. All right.
Bye-bye.
Also, are we signing off yet? Are we done? Okay. All right. So also check out Drew on KBC 790 Midday Live Talk Radio, Monday to Friday. And also find Mike Catherwood on KROQ-FM.
The Kingpin Station.
He's in the real world now.
I was at Music Inc. yesterday, and they had the K-Rock booth there. There's just something institutional about K-Rock.
Something about the name.
he's so happy, you can tell. And also, you can find all the podcasts on drdrew.com, and as well as where you can find Bob on his podcast, Don't Die. Is
it's
that right?
It's just a Don't Die movement. But just go to Rehab Bob. That's where everything I have
and that's
is.
Where you can find him. And Mike Catherwood is at Mike Catherwood. And, of course, you can find him on the new amazing Swole Patrol.
Oh,
Which we're going to be doing live on Facebook in about 20 minutes with an amazing guest. I'm so excited. And also, Drew will be back as well after he gets off the phone with the President of the United States.
Perfect.
That's not a joke, by the way. That's the craziest thing I've ever
heard. It's a reality television world, Mike.
And the guest is Natalie Jill. She's a health and fitness guru who's driving up here from San Diego to meet Mike. So that's pretty amazing. And we appreciate
driving,
you guys
she's driving
all
up
watching.
Here to meet Drew. Let's and, be realistic.
Yeah, you and me have been in the same spot for 20 years.
Since we've actually figured out how to use this platform, I hope it works for the next show. And we'll see you in a bit. Thank
you. All right, see you later.
Thank you.
Well, we're so pleased to have Hydrolite back. Hydrolite is something that we and my family use just about every day, and it is simply the best oral rehydration product I have ever seen. And there are many reasons you should keep some around. I got the flu. I relied on Hydrolite because I knew it would rehydrate me the way an IV fluid would. We all have heard about the flus and the diarrheas, and they all knock you out. Staying well hydrated is critical to getting over these conditions. Even if you manage to avoid getting infected, your schedule is half as busy as mine. Getting 8 glasses of water a day isn't likely to happen. And you don't need it if you've got the proper hydration product, Hydrolite. That is the beauty. Whether you're sick or not, you can absolutely benefit from proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water. Hydrolite does this better than a sports drink or water alone. That's right, better. And it comes in great flavors like orange, berry, lemonade. It's available in a pre-mixed powder. My personal preference, little effervescent tablets. You can simply drop in a bottle of water or a glass of water, and you're done. You got it, and you are rehydrated. And compared to sports drinks, Hydrolite delivers up to 4 times the electrolytes with 75% less sugar. I know. Don't buy into the hype of the brands. Use Hydrolite. It's a better product. I'm telling you, I had intended to invent it. They got there first, so I'm all behind them. Hydrolite solutions are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. Order Hydrolite today at Hydrolite.com/DRDREW. That is Hydrolite.com/Dr. Drew. And for a limited time, our listeners can save 30% on Hydrolite. We actually buy in bulk in our family, so we're going to click through. Believe me, just click the banner on my site and use the code DRDREW18. That is DRDREW18.
Remember, you can find all these podcasts at drdrew.com. The Dr. Drew podcast, the This Life podcast, and the Adam and Drew podcast, which is available 5 days a week. Find them all on iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Subscribe and get it first. And if you're really happy, click on the Amazon banner at drdrew.com to help support the show. We'll thank you for it. If you join the email list via drdrew.com/contact, we'll send you a weekly infusion newsletter with Dr. Drew's news. We're so grateful when you get in touch. We read all your emails and we'll bring you the subject matter you want to hear about.
You live.